special lectures. This is Dr. Vasanta Rangacha from Andhra Pradesh, Anantapur. It's Krishnadevaraya University in Anantapur district of Andhra Pradesh. And she, your actual training is in history.
Yeah, that's an art history.
Yeah. She is an art historian, and today she is going to present what is called Board Games, a Metaphor for Spiritual Growth. So,
thank you very much. Good afternoon. At the outset, I express my deep sense of thanks to Dr. Shavanaka and other hosts who facilitated me to be here at the Center for Hindu Studies for nearly 8 weeks as a visiting fellow to deliver a couple of lectures. I thank them very much. Also, I am aware that this center's focal point is on theology, philology, and spiritual and other related aspects. But I am sure, though I speak on a game, I would concentrate or I would focus more on the religious aspects of the game rather than the game itself. And my today's talk would focus on one board game, that's Snakes and Ladders. But before that, I shall draw your attention to a brief history of what is a game or play, what are board games, and how many variations are found in board games, and whether there are any research has been carried out on board games, and do games, these board games, have any religious character, and if so, is it universal or not? So let us question ourselves, what's a game or a play? Play has always been an essential aspect of growing up. It develops the interpersonal and competitive skills of a child, and at a more conscious level, many other skills. It is unfortunate that play is often a forgotten and underestimated aspect of a child's development. Games are competitive forms of play. Games have rules which are institutional, public, and systematic. Play and games are about boundaries. Alternate realities, virtual realities, and even religious realities can be expressed in both games and play. The action which takes place in play and in game is untrue. That is, a soccer match or a chess game is not a war. A bullfight is not a hunt, regardless of the emotional or verbal similarities. Nevertheless, the human capacity to imagine and create alternate realities in play and games appears to be unending. What's the truth of such realities? There does seem to be social and psychological truth to games and play. Social scientists focus on the strategic and role-playing aspect of games. Rational calculation, social integration, decision-making and strategic choice, value transmission, dissimulation, rules for breaking rules, and the art of impression management to avoid embarrassment to self and others. And coming to the categories of game, we have several categories, and it can be categorized as solitaire games, gambling games, race games, children's games, and lawn games. Many games fall into more than one of these categories, so the most common way of classifying games is by the equipment that is required to play them. And board games probably make up the largest category of games. They are usually played on a flat surface made of cardboard, wood, or other material. Players place the board on a table or on the floor and then sit around it to play. In most board games, pieces are placed on the board and moved around it. Dice, cards and other equipment can be used. Then what is a board game? A board game is any game played with a pre-marked surface with counters or pieces that are moved across the board. Simple board games are often seen as ideal family entertainment as they can provide entertainment for all ages. Some board games such as chess have intense strategic value and have become lasting classics. And board games have played an important role as research objects in the sciences of this century. At first, games were studied from a historical perspective. In 1944, von Neumann and Morgenstern provided a basis for using games and board games in the computer sciences and in economics, such as in the field of game theory. Research on board games accelerated with the research on chess, in particular chess masters, which has proved fundamental in the cognitive sciences since De Groot, followed by Newell and Simon and others. Chess is quite dominant in most fields, but slowly other championship games enter these fields as examples or tools in research. Only recently has research on board games other than chess has been possible. Since Thomas Hyde, there are historical descriptive works on board games. However, even in 1952, when Murray published A History of Board Games Other Than Chess, research did not suffice to warrant an important shift in attention in the sciences. These other games had rules, boards, pieces, players, and context unknown to the academic world, and these are never studied. Since 1952, some disciplines of research have started to consider games and board games other than chess. Studies of sculptured game boards in art history in 1990 and a contextual analysis of board games in anthropology in 1985 are just examples from the field of Mancala games. This interest from art history, anthropology, and also archaeology, psychology, and linguistics has grown rapidly since the 1980s. And now, the next question is, would you believe that these board games or games and play have a religious character? I would say yes. Hindu sacred writings, for example, picture the world as a game of dice between the god Shiva and Parvati. The Hindu act of creation was conceived as Leela, meaning play, flux, and movement, in the dream or imagination of Brahman, the divine cosmic principle. Similarly, the Western scriptures tell us that the Hebrew divinity played with his companion Wisdom at creation. Then Wisdom was at his side each day, his darling and delight, playing in his presence, continually playing on the earth. Chinese yin and yang cosmic dualism was often set in game forms portraying magical competitions. North American Indians saw the opposition between night and day, winter and summer, east and west, morning and evening as game rivalry and often played ceremonial games to please the gods and obtain blessings from them. Sumo wrestling tournaments originated within Japanese Shinto religion. The Greek philosopher Plato equated play and holiness, that is, man as God's plaything. In Greek mythology, the gods themselves played games and intervened in the games of humans. The Greeks developed the Olympic Games. These festivals were devoted to the worship of Zeus and were viewed as the moral equivalent of war. The Christian emperor Theodosius suppressed the Olympic Games in early Christianity, calling them pagan rites. However, in the time of the Middle Ages, the church did allow the tournament and horse races to honor the Virgin Mary. The tournaments and jousting with the aim of unhorsing one's opponent became mass entertainment as early as the 800s. And now we just jump to the various types of board games. This is from royal tombs from Sumeria and called as Game of Ur and Tau, which belongs to 2500 BC. And this is Chinese chess called as game Go, which has complex chess in its own complexity and scope. And this is the Mankala game. This is the national game of Uganda. And the bottom one is a typical Indian Mankala game. And this is chess and its variants. The first one is four-handed Indian chess, and later developed into two-handed Indian chess, and later to Persian chess and Byzantine chess. And finally ended up to European chess, which is now existing as the modern chess. And the next we find this Burmese form of chess, and Cambodian and Thai, and this is Korean chess, and this is Shogi, the Japanese, and this is Chinese chess. And I would like to highlight, these are all forms of board games. And this is another form of board game, that's fox and geese, and it's also called as tiger goat game, and which is called as Puli Meke Aata in Andhra and Baga Chal in Calcutta. And the next one is solitaire, and this is the famous nine men's Maurice, and this is called as Dadi in India. And the bottom one you can really identify as something very similar to the Homakunda in India. And this is draughts, and the right-handed side are from Sri Lanka. And this is the famous backgammon game. And this is the national game of India, that's Pachisi. And the right bottom one is the modern Ludo. And you are all aware that this was the famous game that was played during the epic period. And it's also called as Akshakrida in Sanskrit. And now I come to the presentation proper. That's snakes and ladders. And this is popularly called in India as Paramapada Sopanam or Mokshapatam. And until now, we have seen many different types and classifications of board games. And some games are simplified simulations of real life. These are popular for they can intermingle, make-believe and role-playing along with the game. Popular games of this type include Paramapada Sopanam or Mokshapatam. This ancient race game like Pachisi originated in India, although the author is not sure when. It's a game of morality with the basis of the ladders being located on squares representing various types of good, and the more numerous snakes coming from squares representing various forms of evil. The squares of virtue on the original game are faith in the grid 12, reliability in 51, generosity in 57, knowledge in 76, asceticism 78. The squares of evil are disobedience 41, vanity 44, vulgarity 49, theft 52, lying 58, drunkenness 62, debt 69, rage 84, greed 92, pride 95, murder 73, and lust 99. The game is Hindu and was used to teach children about the religion. In that, the good squares allow a player to ascend higher in the league of life, whereas evil will reduce a player back through reincarnation to lower tiers of life. Presumably, the last square 100 represents Nirvana. The morality of the game must have appealed to the Victorians, who took to the game when it was published in 1892 in England. Called Snakes and Ladders, the game play was pretty much the same, but some of the vices and virtues were renamed according to Victorian ideals. So penitence, thrift and industry elevated a player up a ladder to squares labeled grace, fulfillment and success, while indolence, indulgence and disobedience slid a player down to poverty, illness and disgrace. The number of ladders and snakes were also equalized. Chutes and Ladders is a game produced by Hasbro and mainly distributed in the United States of America. It is Hasbro's versions of snakes and ladders. As with most board games, people play this for entertainment. Yet this game also highlights certain central Indian religious ideas, particularly the notions of karma and reincarnation. To play, all players begin with their pieces on space number 36, which has a silhouette of a human being. Each player rolls a dice and advances his or her piece the corresponding number of squares. Note that the board ascends in a zigzag left to right, then right to left. If a piece lands on a square bearing the head of a snake, one slides down, whereas squares with the bottom of a ladder lead one upwards. The first player to reach square 100, the heaven of final deliverance, wins the game. Each snake or ladder is not only associated with specific faults and virtues, but also with particular rewards and punishments. For example, disobedience, square 41, leads to birth as a donkey, the most stubborn of animals. Impurity leads to birth as a dog, the epitome of impurity, since dogs eat just about anything. And vanity leads to birth as a peacock. Some of these connection with fowls and animals, pride and horse, greed and monkey, and so forth, have strong connections in Indian culture, but are less apparent to outsiders. In the same way, certain virtues lead to specific desirable outcomes. Notice that there are more snakes than ladders, and that the ladders tend to be clustered in the top of the board, whereas the snakes are spread throughout the board. One of the messages here is that spiritual development is a long process for which one may not see rewards for a long time until one gets to the upper half of the board. Whereas the hazards are present up to the very end, notice that the penultimate space on the board is the serpent of desire, which takes one almost all the way down to the bottom. Another message here is the transiency of the heavens as a place of refuge. Even if one lands in the heaven of Vishnu, that is 97, only 3 spaces from the end, on the next turn one must roll again, and a 2 spot brings a tremendous fall. The religious message here is that until one attains final liberation, one is continually at risk. And there are different versions of the play. And this is, each player starts with a token in the one grid square and rolls a single die, moving the token the number of squares indicated by the die roll. If on completion of this move, the land on the lower number of the pair of squares with a ladder, they move their token forward to the higher numbered square. If they land on the higher numbered square of a pair with a snake, they must move their token back to the lower numbered square. If they have rolled a 6 with their die, they may roll again. Otherwise, the play passes to the next player in turn. The winner is the player whose token reaches square 100 first. Snakes and ladders, simplicity, and the seesawing nature of the contest make it popular with younger children. But the lack of any skill component in the game generally makes it uninteresting for older players. And this is another game. This is a game of knowledge and is nothing less than the game of life and karma, providing insight into our own consciousness and a key to divine knowledge. 3 things are necessary for one or more to play the game of Leela, that's the divine play. The game board and a die, that's of karma, and a significant object that belongs to the player, such as a pawn, to serve as the player's symbol during the game. This board with 72 squares represents a virtue or vice, an aspect of human consciousness or a plane of being. The player's progress is dictated by the fall of a die, corresponding to the forces of karma. the seven planes through which the player must pass before he reaches the eighth plane, the plane beyond all planes, or the seven chakras. This game is not merely an entertainment, but a serious method of understanding the phenomenal world of Maya and the spiritual nature of our individual self that leads us to the journey towards liberation. The saints who invented this game used the game board to recognize the present state of their own being. By playing the game time and again, consciously observed which snake brought them down and which ladder took them up. Observing their own inner self, they could tell whether they had understood what it is to be not involved. The uniqueness of this game, the game of self-knowledge, is that it is a study of scriptures and discovery of the self at the same time. And this is a game set with a board, a die, and pawns, and on which one works out past, present, and future karma. However, this is a lot more than the game. Rather, it is an amazing work concerning not only Indian religious culture, belief, philosophy, but also a singular description of the soul's progress along the path to enlightenment and winning the game. It gives a very in-depth, beautiful, and deep, thought-stirring description of each level of consciousness, which is represented on the game board as squares by different names and influenced by the placement of the snake and ladders which are depicted on the board. Just studying the board itself is a life's work. Playing the game is another life's work. Understanding the 72 commentaries arranged in rows which corresponds to the chakras is going to take lifetime as well. This is the game of gods, kings, sages, and philosophers. It is extremely ancient, simple, yet really quite complex. Which end of the spectrum it leans toward depends on the players involved and their level of spiritual enlightenment and awareness. Each row of spaces representing a level of human consciousness or plane of being may be explained in separate chapters describing the various steps along, into, up to, and out of that particular plane of consciousness and spiritual development. Each player uses an object which is personal in nature, such as a pawn, to move along the board. It is said that playing over and over, one can tell by the areas one continually gravitates to and the patterns which the die throws take. The level of one's spiritual being, one's past and future spiritual development as well. The game was originally called Jnana Chaupat and provides keys to understanding of the knowledge of the Vedas, Shrutis, Samhitas and the Puranas. Playing the game is playing with the manifested divine knowledge found in the aphorisms and doctrines of Yoga, Vedanta and Sankhya, which flows in the body of the Hindu tradition of philosophy and lifestyle. After a few minutes of playing, the game board starts to play with the mind and intellect of the player as well as the ego. And the strong sense of self-identity, the easiness of the player. And coming to the game and the karma, birth is entry into the karmic play. The die is the karmic player and the individual self, a symbol that moves from house wherever the die determines. Before taking birth, one is beyond the game. Once birth is taken, the law of karma binds one. This world is karma land. Desire leads the player to accept the bondage of karma. If one has no desire to play, one will not be attracted towards a game. But play is in the nature of consciousness, could not remain motionless without playing. So, let there be light, let there be play. The absolute became many from one, to play the game. When the player decides to enter the game, he is reenacting the primordial creation when the absolute stirred from inaction and began the macrocosmic play in which we are all but microcosms. Once a decision to play is made, the player must abide by the rules, that's dharma, and the bondage of the karma die. It is here that the player first enters into the game after throwing a six. When five subtle elements, ether, fire, air, water, earth, and one consciousness unite, these six initiate the movement of the player's symbol across the board. Each birth is the opening of a new game, and the object of attainment in each game is the same cosmic consciousness. There is no other directive, no other purpose in playing the game. The game is just to complete the cycle. Birth is the key. It opens the doors of the game, and the player begins to vibrate as he starts on eternal voyage, his journey towards completion. And coming to the game and the Maya aspect, when one accepts entry into the game as a player, awareness of unity is lost in the obsession of play. This taking over the consciousness is the fun of play. The one becomes many to play a game of cosmic hide and seek with itself. To fulfill his ego, the player sets up the game and its rules and commits himself to playing them not to the end. The one is reality, multiplicity is illusion. This illusion of multiplicity is created by the wheeling power of the one, that is Supreme Consciousness. This wheeling power is called Maya, Shakti or Maya. This wheeling power creates the illusion of me and mine or thee and thine, which creates ignorance in the individual consciousness. Those who realize this ignorance call it avidya. So yogis also call Maya avidya. This ignorance comes to individual consciousness through the mind. That's why yoga is a practical device to stop the modifications of mind, and yoga's aim is to arrest mind, to stop the inner dialogue, to go beyond the mind and realize one's true nature beyond the illusion of me and mine. The world of names and forms is Maya. Maya is the stage and setting within which the player enacts his microcosmic tragicomedy. Maya is the play itself, presenting the player with simulations and patterns which offer him subtle clues to the understanding of his own true nature. This illusion can be seen at every level. The human body itself is not a unit of existence, but is composed of countless numbers of cells and micelles. If each cell starts growing a sense of me and mine, each human body will become a subcontinent. It is the individual ego, ahankara, that creates separate units of existence, but this in itself is Maya. Ego cannot function without mind, as mind cannot without sensory organs. So it is only after the mind is brought to a suppressed state that the sense of me and mine can be completely annihilated. By yoga alone can this state be achieved and an end brought to this illusory sense of being an independent unit. After realization of truth through a direct experience of reality in samadhi, Maya can be understood and the human psychodrama can be observed as divine play, as Leela. Maya Shakti is the power that brings forth the evolution of the phenomenal world. It makes this possible by interplay of the three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. Cosmic consciousness becomes individual consciousness by its own Maya. In Hindu literature, Maya has been described in a very many contexts. And yet it is impossible to explain all about it. It is an infinite as cosmic consciousness itself. The only job confronting the player is the realization that he is a player, that the sense of separation he feels is illusory. All that the player perceives of the phenomenal world exists within himself in the form of sensory input and is illusory. Modern sciences that try to investigate the nature of truth verify this statement. Both modern science and ancient wisdom believe in a single primordial substance to which the various forms of matter can be reduced. All phenomenal existence is but one of the many manifestations of the same underlying unity. The elements are varied forms of this one substance. The variety of our experience is due to the permutation and combination of atoms. There is really only one game, and the game in which each of us is a player acting out his role. That the game is Paramapada Sopana, the universal play of cosmic energy. The game is a divine play. It is present in the nature of the Supreme Self. It is this playful nature which creates the world of names and forms, the phenomenal world. The game is life itself, energy expressed in the myriad forms of and feelings presented continuously to the self. The essence of the player in his ability to become, to adopt a role. That which is the essence of the player can enter into any role. But once the player enters into the game, once he assumes the identity of the persona he adopts, he loses sight of his true nature and gets caught by Maya. He forgets the essence of what it is to play the game. The karma die decides his moves. The purpose of this small game is to help the player gain this ability to withdraw from his identifications and see how he might become a better player. For this game is a microcosm of the larger game. Contained within the 72 spaces of the game board is the essence of thousands of years of self-exploration, the heart of Indian tradition. As the player moves from space to space, square to square, he begins to see patterns in his own existence, emerging with ever-deepening clarity as his understanding of the game broadens. His sense of detachment grows as he sees each stage as temporary, something to move beyond. And once the temporality of any space becomes a reality for the player, he can detach from that space, let it go as he seeks to discover ever more about the wonder that is being. As with all games, here too there is a goal, an object to be attained. Because the essence of the player is his ability to identify his own chance of winning. The game is to identify with that which is his source. This is cosmic consciousness, the essence of pure being, which transcends time and space and knows no limits, is infinite, absolute, eternal, changeless, the all, without attributes, beyond both name and form. The game ends when the player becomes himself, the essence of play. This is nirvana or moksha. The creators of the game saw it foremost as a tool for understanding the relationship of the individual self to the absolute. I feel that this is a great experience in playing this Paramapada Sopanam. And I don't think that anyone with an interest in Indian culture on any level will be disappointed by this game. If you have a common area for sitting around and relaxing, you might want to play this game and would prove to be one of the most unusual and truly enlightenment experience of your life. Thank you very much.
Unless people want to see them as they ask questions. The game is open.
Yeah. Either you can raise some questions or you can even play the game.
Yeah. I have a question.
Okay.
Hey, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. I was looking at this, how do you say, spaces, and very interesting. 12, there's something which makes the soul elevated to the human being state.
Pardon?
It's cut off.
Oh, faith.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
It's cut off. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Number 12 is good.
Number 12. No, that's a different thing.
That
I think.
Yeah, it's number 12. It says faith.
Yeah.
And then I was just wondering, because it seems this stage is still within the animal stage.
Yeah.
So what kind of faith?
Yeah, it's a sheer faith. That's what the Indian tradition and philosophy speaks, that if you have a strong faith, you will get the birth of a human being.
Right.
Oh, that's what it indicates. See, if you happen to lie in the square of 12, that's with a strong faith, not to be born as an animal or a lower being. So tradition speaks that you should be a manava janma. So then if you have a faith, I think you will have a human birth.
Yeah, but like a faith in what? I mean, like, does this indicate?
Yeah, faith in the religious scriptures.
Right, but...
the speak.
But the interesting thing is that it seems it's still animal stage. That's somewhere before pig, before becoming pig. I don't know what kind of animal. But so that indicates that animal also has some choice to...
Yeah, of course, of course, of course.
Wonderful stories. I remember wonderful stories of the Hitopadesha, of animals who decide to commit themselves to faith. And sometimes they're not supposed to. They're supposed to go be an animal for a while.
I think hidden in the board here is also, I think, this notion of levels of consciousness. So it's probably, one thing that interests me is if there is a textual kind of backup. I don't think there is any one single text that informs this whole game, but I think the drawers of this game probably drew upon several textual references.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm just wondering what would have actually led them, for instance, to think that you could go from, of course, devotion, you know, takes you right to the realm of Vishnu Loka. But then this asceticism takes you straight.
No, but I would just like to interrupt here. See, these games are multi. There are varieties of snakes and ladders. Each, I have put before you some 5 varieties. Oh, there are umpty number of varieties, and each board has been drawn either from different Puranas or and sometimes it's their own imagination too. And we do not have a specific board to speak about, so we cannot finally conclude just by looking at this board, this is what the Indian tradition speaks. No, this is really untrue. And because that's a different board and which speaks about different moralities, virtues. And each and in each board there are number of the numbers of snakes and ladders differs. So we have to be very careful in talking about the animal plane, the human plane, and the yogic plane. It's you have to be very cautious.
Well, I think they seem to be playing with some philosophical ideas.
Yeah, of course. That can be what I spoke to you is a general aspect. Oh, it speaks about the karma and the maya theory. And something like a birth and rebirth theory. And one has to be very cautious about the evil and the good.
What I'm curious is the assumptions that these writers of the game seem to have made, some philosophical assumptions. I don't know how seriously they thought through it, but somehow they seem to think that knowledge will take you to the Brahmaloka,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of, you know, odd, really. And then asceticism takes you straight to, you know, there's nothing beyond it. That's the end. And then you can get to Vishnuloka, and still there is no guarantee. That's kind of, you know, it's interesting how they assume some of these philosophical presuppositions.
I feel it's very Vedic, and I don't see anything that is really shocking out of.
No, no. Well, it's.
Brahmaloka is, obviously, I think.
Well, if you use, for instance, Shankara's assumption, jnana is simultaneously Brahma.
No, I'm just talking about the Vedic themselves, with the interpretation.
We don't know whether this is informed by Vedic stuff, but yeah, I think it's much later.
It's quite later. And the earliest this snake and ladder board is available only from 7th century.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure this
not
is
earlier than that.
Not
earlier than that.
Any particular Vedic or anything, or even philosophical text.
And very interestingly, this board is. First appeared in the Jaina scriptures rather than Hindu scriptures.
What's the evidence for so early as the 7th century?
Yeah, that's the Jaina manuscript belonging to 7th century AD. That's the earliest manuscript where we have found this.
Was the manuscript in the south or in
the? No, it's in Gujarat. That's the earliest manuscript.
By the 7th century?
No, the manuscript belongs to 7th century
AD.
Yeah, AD. The game may be a little earlier, or to explain the various stages, they might have made use of this, something like a board, not a game actually. Invariably, this board is present in most of the Jaina monasteries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very
so
interesting,
like
rather than Hindu.
Do you have a picture of the board?
In some of the modern Jaina monasteries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not the 7th century?
No, no,
not
no, not at all. Not at all.
It's a great source for trying to get a picture of what people did think, whether it's Vedic or Quranic or whatever, what parts of it sort of filtered through to the popular people. But one of the interesting things about the board, as you say, it's a microcosm for the whole world. See that the whole of life and the whole of the spiritual process. And of course, not everyone in life, it's interesting that not everyone will actually be aiming for moksha in this life. People will be aiming, perhaps, you know, in theory, could people be playing and at the same time thinking, if I make it to Brahmaloka, it's okay.
No, it's okay.
Life, I'll get
it's okay. But it's for the Westerners. I'll tell you, for an Indian, that it's imbibed in the very soul of an Indian. It's a lifestyle of an Indian to attain the moksha. And also a housewife or a household. They want to explain the things to children in a very simpler fashion. They do not want to go into the scriptures, explain them in a Sanskrit, or look into big voluminous books. They want to make everything simplified, as simplified as possible, and to be approachable to small children. And because all Vedic scriptures were prohibited to women, and also to other castes, and how do they be approached? How do they approach these Shastras? So this is all simplified forms.
It's interesting partly because I think that sometimes when you read texts on Hindu religion, it can almost sound as if people, moksha is only for certain people, for men in later life, maybe only for Brahmins, but not the goal, the spiritual goal immediately for women, for other people, etc.
No.
And this contradicts that.
No, it doesn't contradict.
Well,
but as far as being an Indian, I would like to... represent the Indian feeling that everyone wants to attain moksha, whether it's a Shudra or Brahmin, in their own way. It's not that a Brahmaloka, they are not satisfied with the Brahmaloka or Ishwaraloka. They want to attain the heaven. Oh, this is very much mixed with the DNA.
this is sort of a, okay, this is a game, and you said that maybe children would play it, but would others play it in the sense of just having a feel of what God wants to say to me right now, you know, that God is speaking to me through this particular game, yes, in a sense of divination, maybe, or understanding where I am, maybe my problem is my, you know, whatever, you know, pride or something.
I have never seen adults playing this game in all my sort of life.
No, you mean to say that the only children play this game?
No, would people other than children play this game in the sense of seeing, playing it in a sense of seeing the hands of God, you know, or what God is telling me about myself?
No, the answer is no. Even to be very frank, even children, they don't play this game in India now.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost forgotten. It's almost forgotten. And now we are initiating. We are putting them into schools. Putting all Indian games into schools. Initiating them that this is an indigenous game. Why don't you learn something? Almost all schools have forgotten this. There are many number of Indian indigenous games which speaks about the Indian tradition, life, philosophy, but they have forgotten. How about, see, when children already they have forgotten, how about the youngsters, adults? No, not at all. They are much very interested in cricket and football or chess.
As a kid, as I played, all I remember is just fighting. I mean, we fought like them. I mean, as we played, we never thought. I never had a single blissful experience when I was kid. I just, you know, we were kind of, you know, arguing, playing, competing. That's the kind of game.
And it's surprising that even that calendar, I could not get. I had to go to Shivakashi and get those calendars. It's a very old calendar, which depicts this snake and ladder game. It's a very old calendar, belonging to 1956.
Actually, as a child, I was playing this game too, but it was a totally sort of secular version of it. And I was surprised that you say that they start at 36 on the board at the human. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Like the game I used to play was sort of similar in nature. It was with firemen, and you had ladders and poles or like water hoses down.
Mm.
And it was just you started at one. And there was a fire, and you sort of had to go all the way up, and at the top, then you were out of the fire. There was the game, but it was like totally secular. You had like, you know, there was no connection, but you had a ladder, but it was like no connection between the place where the ladder started and where it ended. It was like here you have like, you know, devotion leads to heaven or Vishnu and things like that. So it was like, you know, curious. I was interested to see how it, where the game actually came from. My fireman.
Of course, the game has come from India, but only the different versions might have appeared in the other part of the globe. And there is one game that has been recently invented in US, that's with a snake and a bow, rather than ladder, it's a bow. Yeah, I'm yet to get that game. It's a very recent game that has been invented on the basis, the total basing on this model. So I think there may be varieties.
I think what would be interesting is to actually find out if there are any historical references to whether this was at some point introduced as a kind of a basic Hindu kind of...
Yeah, I told you, this was first found out in 7th century AD in a Jaina manuscript.
Yeah,
later in inscriptions and literary, we find some references in literary evidences to explain in a simple fashion the good and bad of life and the morality, ethics, virtues, to explain in a simpler fashion. That reference we find both in epigraphical and literary
My point is, if this were a kind of a Hindu kind of elementary catechism type of thing, why was it found in the Jaina? Unless Jaina cosmology kind of recast this in a different way and then thought, you know, through these things differently from the Hindu kind of...
No, I'll tell you, as far as India is concerned, it's many things to be still explored. Just because that we have an evidence of Jaina manuscript, we cannot totally deny that it was not existing in Hindu scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
We need to explore and find out whether anything is available earlier than this Jaina scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really difficult. This is, I tell you, in India, no work has been carried out on this subject. And I think very, very little, very little. So I think many scholars should take up this type of work and do it.
It's interesting that it calls upon precisely the bit that's common to the Buddhist, the Jain, the Hindu.
Yeah, very much.
Moksha, you know, that's straightforward. Everyone has that. This one's interesting partly because I love this idea that they map the good and the bad. There's the basic moral maps. But this one seems to be even more complicated, like many facets of life. We've got gods, we've got sages, we've got animals. Ganesh is liberally sprinkled throughout the text. It seems to have, like, in a way, an even more sort of complex analysis of different parts of life. But you're saying it can be consciousness, it can be so many different sort of kinds of analysis on the board. Are these all gods, or are they?
Yeah, some of them are gods. And there are exclusively Shaivite Paramapada Sopanam and Vaishnavite Paramapada Sopanam. To distinguish between Shaiva and Vaishnava. We have? No, I could not get those samples. So. I think it's a mixture of Shaiva and Vaishnava.
Are there any correlations between these numbers and an item? For example, is there any meaning that to say human beings and put in number 36? Or not so much?
Not so much, actually, but I would like to say that's a lower plane. That's what I was trying to explain you.
Mm.
See, right up to the lower plane, we don't have ladders, except there is one ladder to reach 36. Otherwise, up till 4 steps, or 40, we don't have any ladders. This is the bottom of the... So, you know, even we can even explain that's Patala Loka, Manushya Loka, and Devaloka, even that can also be explained.
There seems to be some kind of primitive evolution that's followed. From dog is the...
Yeah, that's exactly.
Right at the bottom, and then man is the number 36, and from there everything changes.
Yeah, from ape to man, something like a Darwin's theory.
Fish doesn't really fit the picture.
Yeah, I understand. Fish should have been in the lower plane.
After the dog.
And then is there also any meaning that is there always snake used for going down?
Yeah, because he wants to explain more on the Kundalini Chakra. Oh, it's similar to the snake. It has been compared with snake.
Right.
That's exactly the Indian philosophy.
There's your desire 99.
I wanted to ask you about your overall interpretation. You spoke, it seems to me, a lot about the yoga
because
you mentioned chakra, you mentioned basically calming the mind, you mentioned chitta vritti nirodha, you mentioned samadhi as a means to that. Now, you said there was not single interpretation, so I was wondering what actually led you to give that overall overarching.
Yeah, this is my interpretation, which I would like to, because that's what I that's what I feel.
This is what transpires from the overall.
But we don't have any explanation in any scriptures.
Uh-huh.
We need to explain for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that this is apt explanation for this thing.
So that was your personal take on it.
Yeah. And most of the scholars agree with this explanation.
Uh-huh.
And this is what it teaches us. No, if you have any explanation,
well,
it's welcome.
Then it's not...
No,
what
it's
I mean
welcome.
Is, what
if
I mean
you have any
it's
other
not
interpretation.
Pan-Indian, because you did say that there was no single interpretation of this.
No,
and
no, not exactly.
That it is
not exactly.
Yoga
they don't... See, if there is no scriptural explanation. It's all oral explanation. If you want to give an oral explanation, you can give. But when you want to, combine the scriptural references with this, and we need to look into the Maya, karma, and Advaita Vedanta very much.
No, but I would think that concepts of karma, fine, it's an Indian.
Yeah.
I would agree with that, or moksha.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to theory of chakras or nirvikalpa samadhi or chittavritti nirodha, these are specific. A specific jargon is being used in one particular tradition.
Yeah.
So we're not no longer into the
Indian.
Yeah,
I understand.
Concept.
Yeah, I understand. No, I understand that yoga is an Indian.
As a term, yes, but of course it means various things in various
Patanjali Yoga Sutra is
it's not accepted by everyone, is it?
Yeah.
No, but it's very well known by everyone. So if you talk about the Kundalini chakra, everyone knows what you're talking about.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that everybody will adhere to it.
It doesn't mean everyone will play the game.
Well,
if it's a great Vedanta, you're not that well.
And then, otherwise, how do we overcome that? How do we overcome chitta vritti nirodha if you don't rely on chitta vritti nirodha? How do we overcome this?
Well, surely the various means. I mean, the goals are always different.
No, how do we relate?
The
when
means
see, otherwise,
different.
How do we relate that concept into this game? It's only by chitta vritti nirodha.
Well, it depends how you conceive of deliverance to begin with.
Of course.
For most of the kids, though, they won't be so theologically specific.
No, the problem is that it's not just for kids. You also mentioned,
yeah,
for
it's
example,
not for kids.
It's a way.
It's a
way to check one's spiritual status.
Yeah.
Right.
But
along the way,
if you see
a pattern as you're playing this game, that you're stuck in vanity for some reason, it says a lot about your status, your moral status, your spiritual advancement.
But there's no way that in India, there's no way that you can invent a game that every philosophical and theological tradition is going to sign up to as representing their perspective. So obviously some Brahmins or, you know, smart people have created this. I would say it would come from the Brahmin to give to Kshatriyas or something to help moderate, to help them game and think. But obviously it's going to come from that Brahmin's perspective, his sampradaya, his tradition. And I don't know, I mean, have you found that there are different philosophical, theological interpretations?
Yeah, of course.
So then it's pretty broad. So every board will have its own thing.
Mm.
You can have a Catholic one.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, I do that memoir from my research, but exactly the same model of game as we find throughout the Hindu sort of references as a microcosm of the world and the rules of chance and the issues of will and free will and determinism and and also plotted onto that map of the world the issues of ethics, of soteriology if you like, as a kind of a value feature, a function that determines the movement on the board, and some sort of soteriological goal that comes up, I find in my own Western continental stuff in Derrida, it comes up after Heidegger, it comes up in Gadamer. I've got a chapter on it in my thesis. But it's interesting because precisely in that sense, it's a structural comment. It's a comment on the structure of how you, if you have a map of the world, you can map whatever your cultural, ethical sort of set of forces are. And you can map whatever your soteriology is, which makes it so good if you want to do it as a Shaiva, as a Jaina, as a Balta, as a whatever. So it's interesting to me from that perspective to see it done so concretely and richly with different, you know, vocations and gods and worlds on it. It's interesting.
Further comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's really very interesting kind of presentation. And both entertained us and as well as made us think. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.